Type of mobile phone scam called SIM swapping.
This was one of the largest data breaches in history.
We are playing fast and loose with our data.
It's important to understand the sheer scale here.
Surveillance capitalism is driven to shape and influence our behavior.
It's just kind of a shrug, like, well, what can you really do?
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Signal Jam. I'm your co-host, Michael.
And I'm Jay. Thank you for once again listening. We're excited to be back.
This episode, we're talking about private chat apps and email providers as part of our Privacy 101 series. Before we dive in, let's cover a few updates. First of all, this is our fifth and last entry in the Privacy 101 series for now. Our intent with the 101s was to go over some simple concepts for newcomers to the privacy space as we worked on building an audience and found a rhythm and a workflow that worked best for us. Now we've hit a point where we feel we've covered enough of the basics that we can begin to branch out and explore some other facets of privacy. So what comes next? I'll save most of the details for the end of the episode, but for now, we'll tease you with a tiny preview.
In our next episodes, we hope to include relevant news updates or articles, but aiming for only those that pertain to topics we've previously covered or mentioned, but also those we feel warrant a signal boost. Most likely, this will be a quick summary, the general takeaway that we have, any possible recommendations, but of course, we will have them linked in the show notes for you to review yourself so you can make your own decisions.
Something else I'm excited to announce is that we've begun preliminary work on a wiki. In the short term, the aim is to publish guides, how-tos, a glossary, and other instructional information about privacy techniques as we personally use them. Once we have a small pool of content going, we plan to open this up to be community-driven so that folks all around the world can offer their own strategies and perspectives for achieving privacy in different jurisdictions. Now, I'll note, we don't have a hard timeline on this, but I sort of expect that it will go live at some point in late quarter two or early quarter three this year. And once it does, we'll have a better pipeline for submitting content. I think the idea right now is to open a repository on our GitHub for pull requests, in addition to manual email or chat submissions, but we'll cross that bridge as we get a little closer to it. One other update on the Promise Threat Model tool. The developer helping us had to take a step back and hand the project off, so I'm working on fine-tuning it in my spare time, little of which, I'll be honest, I have lately. So the delay is on me, and I apologize for that, but I promise we are getting closer, and my personal goal is to have that launched before the wiki. I think the wait will be worth it. It's a pretty handy little thought experiment, and I'm excited to share it with others. So with those things out of the way, let's get into the main topic of the episode, chat apps and email. And before we do, we need to talk about a foundational element of these services, which is encryption, and why not all encryption is equal.
First, let's quickly define what we mean when we talk about encryption. Simply put, encryption is the process of converting or transforming readable information, known as plain text, into an unreadable format called ciphertext, using an algorithm and a key.
Right, and I think it's helpful to think of encryption through an analogy. Oftentimes, it's described as putting a lock on your digital files so that only you or someone authorized can access them.
One comparison I like is a bank vault. Just as a bank vault secures valuables from unauthorized individuals, encryption protects your data. Only someone with the right key can unlock and access the data inside.
I also like to think of it as translating between languages. So let's suppose you're in a room with a friend and a stranger, and you want to pass a note to your friend, but you have to do so by passing the note to a stranger first, who'll then pass it on to your friend. You want to make sure that the note can only be read by your friend. If you both speak English and another language, say Hungarian, and are confident the stranger does not, then you could write your note in Hungarian, pass it along, and know that even if the stranger tries to read your note, only your friend will be able to understand it because they can translate it back to English. This is very similar to how encryption works, where you take information, you encode it with a key, which is really just a set of instructions for how to translate something readable into something unreadable, and can later decode or decrypt that information into something readable again.
Now, with all this talk of data and algorithms, you might be thinking encryption is a modern concept. Maybe you even think it's isolated to technological advancements in the past couple of decades. But in fact, encryption has been around for thousands of years, with one of the earliest and maybe one of the most well-known examples, the Caesar cipher, named after the Roman Emperor Julius Caesar. I won't get too detailed here. The Caesar cipher is a simple substitution cipher, where each letter in the plain text is shifted a certain number of places down the alphabet. For example, with a shift of 3, A becomes D, B becomes E, and so on. So if you wanted to send a secret message saying hello, you would encrypt it as K-H-O-O-R. By today's standards, this is obviously quite basic and certainly easier to crack than many implemented today. But it was effective back in the day. The point we're making here is that we've been seeking private and secure communication for many, many years. Over time, our methods have evolved and become much more complex, but the fundamental idea remains the same: to transform data into an unreadable format that can only be deciphered by someone with the correct key, the intended receiver. Now, why does encryption matter? As previously mentioned, the aim of encryption is for the data to be accessed only by the intended individuals. Events of the last decade or so have shown us the importance of this, that unencrypted communications are vulnerable to interception or misuse, and a lack of or poor encryption is actively exploited. One of the most notable examples is, of course, the Snowden leaks, as mentioned last episode. Former CIA employee and NSA contractor exposed government agencies conducting mass surveillance on citizens. That was intercepting and analyzing vast amounts of unencrypted communications. This taught us the US government and its partners, Five Eyes, Nine Eyes, and 49 Nations, are keen on collecting just about everything we do. That includes the contents of emails, text messages, our voice calls, and more. However, even nowadays, you don't have to wait long to hear of another company or organization impacted by leaks or breaches, where some unencrypted or poorly encrypted data has been exposed by some group or misconfiguration. Or companies themselves abuse their access. Most often referenced here is when Gmail was scanning the contents of emails to gather data for ad personalization and targeting. Some of the biggest changes in the past few years have been in legislation, with much discussion and debate surrounding chat control, where governments or organizations actively seek to monitor online communications, usually with the canned responses, "We do this for your safety, the safety of others, to deter crime," and so on. These attempts at the core aim to break encryption. In the wake of various revelations and today's ever-encroaching big tech and government surveillance, some technology continues to evolve to adapt to the mass surveillance apparatus. This fight rests heavily on encryption. With devices encrypting data at rest by default, HTTPS more widely adopted, end-to-end encrypted messaging rolling out, commercial and consumer VPNs, more common adoption of camera covers, privacy screens, biometric locks, and the use of cryptocurrency.
We also need to talk about briefly why not all encryption is equal. You may notice that many messaging apps advertise themselves as being encrypted or using military-grade encryption, that kind of stuff. So if they're all encrypted, then it doesn't really matter which app we choose, right? If only it were that simple. Encryption comes in two main flavors, which we call symmetric and asymmetric. In that analogy provided earlier, where you're trying to pass a secret note to your friend through a stranger, that scenario would fall under something called symmetric encryption. Symmetric because you and your friend both know the same key, or the same rules, to encode and decode a message. In this case, translating from English to Hungarian, back to English again. A major drawback to this approach, though, is that there is a risk that someone else may know that key too. And that's where asymmetric encryption, sometimes called public key cryptography, which will make more sense in a moment, comes into play. Asymmetric encryption means that the person who encodes the message does not use the same key as the person who decodes it. Now, how is this possible? In public key cryptography, pairs of keys are used to encode and decode information. The key that's used to encode or encrypt something is called a public key, and that's because the key is made public for anyone to see. But the person who decodes that information must use a corresponding key from that pair called a private key, aptly named because it's known only to the recipient and they don't share it with anyone. And these keys are generated in pairs by computers and they share a mathematical relationship so that only the private key can decrypt what is encrypted by its paired public key. So let's zoom out for a moment and see why this matters in the context of communication apps. Instead of passing your secret note to your friend in a room via a stranger, let's just imagine that your secret note is actually an email that you're sending to a friend through Gmail. In a simplified way, Gmail uses a kind of symmetric encryption to protect your message from prying eyes while they transport it from your device to their servers to your recipient's servers. Because that encryption is symmetric, it means they hold the key, which means they can also read your email if they wanted to. So why might they do this? Well, because generally speaking, symmetric encryption is favored for its speed and efficiency. There's less mathematical magic happening in between. Asymmetric encryption is generally slower, but also less vulnerable to certain threats. So what happens when you can't trust or don't want to trust that person delivering your message? Well, then you need to use asymmetric encryption so that the message is encrypted before it even touches the courier by a key that the courier doesn't possess. And that's why not all encryption is equal.
Before getting to options for communications like messaging and email, let's examine why content isn't everything and that metadata matters too. Metadata is data about other data. Put together, the pieces can form an incomplete image, but provide enough for someone to fill in the blanks.
Yeah, and I have a really simple example to share that demonstrates this concept. Here in the U.S., there's a phenomenon known as the Pentagon Pizza Meter. In the 1990s, a franchise owner of Domino's Pizza locations in Washington, D.C., noticed an unusually large number of pizza orders were placed the night before the Gulf War began. A few years later, he noticed the same thing just before President Clinton's impeachment proceedings. Now, this might sound conspiratorial, but the U.S. government actually took note, because years later, during the Obama administration, government officials staggered their pizza orders across many different restaurants the night of the Osama bin Laden raid. And even more recently, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had this to say when he was asked about an X account that monitors traffic at D.C. pizza joints.
I'm aware of that account. I haven't thought of just going to the cafeteria. I've thought of just ordering lots of pizza on random nights just to throw everybody off. Some Friday night when you see a bunch of Domino's orders, it might just be me on an app throwing the whole system off so we keep everybody off balance. Trust me, we look at every indicator. There's a reason Midnight Hammer worked, because we understood open source. We understood classified ways in which the public and others are trying to watch movements.
So what's the moral of the story here? The DC pizza shop owner didn't know exactly what was happening, but he had a pretty good guess that something major in the political world was about to occur. And that, in essence, is how metadata works. You don't need to know the exact specifics about something in order to glean important information about it.
As we have established, metadata shares a detailed picture about us. Air Force General Michael Hayden famously said,
"Yeah, first of all, David's description of what you can do with metadata, and quoting a mutual friend, Stuart Baker, is absolutely correct. Okay? We kill people based on metadata. But that's not what we do with this metadata."
Okay? Thankfully.
Wow, I was working up a sweat there for a second.
And now, for a horrifying example of metadata collection, here's what private messenger WhatsApp collects. We'll start with the basics, your name, profile picture, and status. You might think this seems okay and even expected, but it goes on. Bear with me, this will take a moment. More advanced metadata collection includes IP address, device model, operating system information, battery level, signal strength, app version, browser information, mobile network, connection information, including phone number, mobile operator, or ISP, language, time zone, device operations information, and identifiers, including identifiers unique to Meta Company products associated with the same device or account. When you install the app, the time, frequency, and duration of your activities and integrations, what features you're using on the app, how the app has been configured, whether you're online, groups you're a part of, including their name, group picture, and description, location information. It also receives and shares information about you from other Meta products, like Instagram and Facebook, pairs that with the information they have of you in WhatsApp. What may surprise you about this is they actually have detailed all of this in their privacy policy. We'll link to those in the show notes, and you can see just how much metadata is being collected. We're also going to include an old but still informative, once-circulated FBI document from 2021 in the show notes. What it looks at is the various chat apps and their metadata collection available to law enforcement with a warrant. This includes details on WhatsApp, iMessage, Telegram, Threema, Signal, Line, WeChat, Viber, and Wicker, some of the more popular messaging apps at the time.
There are a lot of chat apps out there. Some are dominant players in the market, like WhatsApp and Telegram, who have really large user bases and are known to make use of encryption. Some are extensions of social media platforms like Facebook Messenger and Snapchat. And then there are others for more niche purposes like Discord, Slack, and GroupMe. So which deserve our attention as privacy enthusiasts, and which do Jay and I recommend? Well, for general purpose messaging, that is for your friends and family, coworkers, group chats, etc., we recommend Signal, which we think has the best bang for your buck. It's free, it's available on Google Play and Apple's App Store, it's intuitive to use, and it's got lots of modern features that make messaging not just private and secure, but frankly fun. Beyond voice and video calls and text messages, there's also an optional social component called Stories, which lets you post videos or image content in a daily feed and choose who in your contacts can see it. Signal also has robust group chats that lets you assign roles, send GIFs and stickers, and run polls. You can also send files, images, contacts, your location, and even a cryptocurrency called Mobile Coin. The appearance of the app can be customized with different colored chats, wallpapers, and even the app icon itself. And you can install Signal on your desktop and iPads, and it syncs across your devices seamlessly. Now, aside from a great-looking user interface and robust features, Signal really shines because of its security and architecture. First off, Signal's open source, and if you remember from our prior episodes, open source means that the code for the software is available for review. Open source is favorable from a privacy perspective because it allows claims by software developers to be verified. So if Signal says that they can't read your messages and the code is open source, then programmers, security researchers, and cryptographers can read that code and see if that's actually true. And they have. Second, the backbone of Signal's encryption, called the Signal Protocol, is widely considered to be a gold standard among security experts and has garnered broad respect. So much so, in fact, that WhatsApp brought on Signal's development team to integrate the Signal Protocol as WhatsApp's encryption backbone. The Signal Protocol uses asymmetric end-to-end encryption and has been audited by security experts many times and received high marks and praise over the years. Another aspect of Signal that makes it stand out is just how little they know about their users, and that's by design. To prove this, Signal publishes some copies of government requests they receive as well as their official legal responses. And to date, all that Signal has been able to produce about a given user is the date that the account was created and the date that the account last connected to Signal servers. Contrast that with what we just heard from Jay about the metadata that WhatsApp collects about you, and the difference is really stark. Lastly, Signal has specific privacy-preserving features right out of the box. For instance, you can toggle read receipts on or off and typing indicators too. You can set your messages to automatically disappear after a period of time, lock the app behind a PIN or a biometric, and relay your messages and calls through Signal servers to protect your own IP address.
To sum up, Signal is a fantastic choice because it's easy to use. Has a well-respected and hardened security architecture that maintains the confidentiality of your messages and keeps Signal from knowing virtually anything about you. Alternatives like WhatsApp and Telegram simply can't hold a candle to it. In WhatsApp's case, the app is not open source, so you can't verify many of their claims. And because it's owned by Meta, they naturally have the incentive to collect information about you for profit. While they can't, in theory, read your messages or listen to your calls, as we've previously outlined, they collect a staggering amount of metadata and share that with Meta. With Telegram, the app is open source, but their encryption model is weaker. Encryption isn't enabled by default, and in some cases, end-to-end encryption is simply not possible. Mix in the collection of metadata and frankly questionable decisions in the last several years, we can only recommend you avoid these if at all possible. So this is our main recommendation for newcomers, but we acknowledge more experienced listeners may have specific critiques or specific circumstances which lead them to prefer alternatives. We want to give people the tools and starting point to make their own choices outside our recommendations. Some of these alternatives include SimpleX, Threema, and Session. What criteria or factors to look for when choosing a messenger might include an audited protocol, encryption of content and metadata, registration requirements, cost, centralization or decentralization, platform compatibility and availability, or the network effect, just to name a few. You might be thinking at this point, what about SMS? Options like SMS or MyPseudo and other VoIP solutions are somewhat out of scope for this episode as they lack uniform end-to-end encryption. However, they are something to keep in mind, and we encourage considering them down the road. Rest assured, we do plan to cover the topic in a later episode or guide, but for now we want you to focus only on encrypted communications. We would be naive to think that getting everyone to use your preferred messenger will necessarily be easy. In some cases, you may feel pushed into lesser or undesirable options. In these instances, it may be controversial, but any encryption is preferred over no encryption. The only thing we do caution and encourage is that the use case be limited to when there are no alternatives, as opposed to just someone not wanting to use your preference. Even then, always look at how you can best isolate, mask, and protect your metadata when using these less desirable apps, going through the settings and hardening what you can. Moving on, when discussing email, much like messaging, we want to keep the recommendations simple. The two we'll focus on are ProtonMail and TudorMail. Neither are perfect, but of the options available, they are the leaders in the space for ease of use, adoption, stability, and are great options for those looking to shift from Gmail or Outlook. First, looking at ProtonMail, a Switzerland-based email provider, they offer end-to-end zero-access encryption, that is, even ProtonMail cannot read your emails. Its clients are open source, uses open source cryptography, has undergone regular independent audits, and benefits from what are currently strong Swiss privacy laws. One thing of a note is for their system to work, their encryption, however, does not cover subject lines or contact details, which for some people can be a deal-breaker. Otherwise, for those that accept that limitation, Proton includes a free tier like many other providers, as well as feature-rich paid plans. These paid plans include increased storage, custom domain support, alias email addresses, and business features. For those of us with contacts outside of Proton, there is support for password-protected emails, which can help to at least keep some level of protection from those other providers. Proton has strong spam, phishing, and tracking protections and is available cross-platform through the web, mobile, and desktop platforms. Most notably, Proton integrates and offers a broader suite. This includes options like a VPN, Drive, Calendar, Password Manager, Authenticator, AI Chatbot, Scribe, Docs, Sheets, Wallet, and Meet for that drop-in replacement for those used to a Google Suite experience. Tutanota, or now Tutamail, is a Germany-based email provider. Like Proton, offers end-to-end zero-knowledge encryption. However, unlike Proton, this covers not just emails, but subject lines, address book entries, and its built-in calendar. For some, this is a step up from Proton. It provides open-source clients, has been audited, and has strong data protection compliance under GDPR and German law. Tutor also offers a free tier, as well as affordable paid plans with increased storage, custom domain support, password protection for those external providers, and spam and phishing protection. Unlike Proton, it isn't quite a full suite. They currently offer mail and calendar with a drive on the roadmap, but Tutor focuses on simplicity, performance, and multi-user business and family features, with hosting powered by renewable energy. Both offer private payment methods like cash or cryptocurrency. However, only Proton Mail currently accepts Bitcoin natively. Tutor alternatively requires gift cards purchased through official resellers. Both have stated they intend to allow other options outside of these in the future. There are features or alternatives like PGP, email aliasing, and custom domains available to keep in mind, but they're outside the scope of this episode for 101s, as the aim is just to encourage the shift to more private options. Obviously, secure and private communications are not limited to messenger apps and email. We chose these two areas to cover for this episode because it's generally the first communication channels that newcomers prioritize when adopting new privacy technologies. We'll likely cover other types of communication and maybe our own personal setups if there's interest in future episodes or blog posts. But for now, we're wrapping up the Privacy 101 series and officially moving on. With that in mind, let's talk about the future of SignalJam.
Yes, I'm actually really eager to do a little bit of reflection and introspection with you on the process so far. Let's recap what we've talked about so far. Episode 2, the first of our 101 series, we talked about password managers, 2FA, and passkeys. Then we discussed threat modeling. We moved on to have a conversation about VPNs and DNS. And last episode, we touched on web browsers and search engines. Now, obviously, there's a lot more that you can talk about within the scope of, you know, elementary privacy topics, but we felt these covered enough of the major bases that someone who's new to the space and wanted to take some first steps would have a leg up listening to these episodes. As far as the experience that we've had together, I'd love to bounce back and forth some comments and ideas that we've had. Jay, what's been your experience as we've been through these last several episodes together?
I feel like we've definitely managed to, I guess, experiment with different rhythms and styles to find out what works best for us, whether it's the preparation process or the recording process. We've had a few technical hiccups along the way, obviously, some growing pains. And of course, you know, working schedule-wise has been, you know, we've had to shift things around here and there. But overall, I'm feeling pretty confident in that. I'd love to hear more feedback from the audience. Maybe there's episodes they preferred or maybe a style they preferred. Mm-hmm. We do hope to obviously get some shorter solo-hosted episodes in throughout there, maybe going forward. Maybe some specific topics we want to discuss individually, but I also enjoy the conversational episodes quite a lot too, or even just those segments where we've started off with, you know, content heavy scripted stuff just to kind of get through the process of the information we want to get out, and then that kind of gradual shift to that conversational style feels has been like it's been a nice transition, I think. What are your thoughts on this?
I've enjoyed the fact that we've bounced between different styles, and that was, you know, kind of mostly as an intentional move to try to strike a balance between something that's more scripted, something that's more conversational and organically flowing. I think going forward with some of the next several episodes that we have coming down the pipes, they'll probably tend to be more conversational just because of the nature of those topics, and we'll touch on those in a second. But yes, the last several episodes have been fun growing pains, you know, some challenges here and there, and I think they've really helped set the stage for the next several episodes that we're excited to get into, which is probably a good segue into some of the next future episodes of SignalJam that we should discuss. So going forward, next episode 7, We are excited and pleased to bring on a special guest. I will not name them now. They are a rather prominent voice within the privacy space and have done some really cool content over the years and just have an interesting perspective on things in general. So very excited to have this person coming to the show. And Jay, what do we have lined up after that?
We do have another guest lined up to talk about surveillance. We'll keep that mysterious and vague too. But I'm excited to hear about what they have to discuss and the particular topic in mind. It's something that I feel like I definitely have a gap in my knowledge, and I'd love to have that gap resolved. As we also mentioned, we are considering weaving in shorter solo-hosted episodes on various topics. Again, if you have any suggestions, please send them our way. And Michael, you also have something else to discuss, I believe.
Yes, one of the next episodes that we are planning to do is about the intersection of politics and privacy. And I'll just kind of keep it general and vague for now. We're not taking a specific political position in terms of partisan positions. We're just talking more about the politics of privacy, if you will. But there's enough happening in the world legislatively and certainly technologically that I think this merits a good conversation. And my hope and intention with this episode is that it will help create or help set the stage for future opportunities to talk with other voices in the privacy space and sort of discuss the happenings, the going-ons, and try to, you know, have a better, more informed conversation about those things. So looking forward to that. I do have a companion blog piece that I'm working on that I hope to release pretty close to the time of that episode too. But should be dense and hopefully will become, you know, more of an ongoing topic that we can discuss as well.
I'm very excited to hear what you have to say about this. You've been talking about this topic for quite some time now, and I'm excited to hear, you know, at length what you have to say on this. It's definitely, I think it's due time that people do discuss it, so I'm excited to hear that. I'm also excited to hear other people chime in on it.
Yeah.
As you say, we're kind of ripping off the Band-Aid and allowing for a bit more open discussion and discourse around it,
right,
which will be exciting to see. So whether that's people want to, you know, submit blog post suggestions or their own submissions, that'd be great. If they have maybe ideas particularly they want to cover in regards to this topic, that'd be great too. In regards to like future episodes, we're planning topics I'd like to discuss include VoIP, specifically focused on the Australian region. My recent experiments with custom domains have been very enlightening, and I'd love to maybe discuss that in more detail at some point, whether that's, you know, a blog post or a solo or co-hosted episode. We'll decide that later down the track. There's obviously, you know, encrypted messengers. I'd love to hear from like developers, maybe from SimpleX or Session.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But that's just something to keep in mind, specifically as they are very popular options still as alternatives to Signal. So I'd love to hear maybe their take or maybe something that might even encourage other people to test out those messengers, not just rely solely on Signal. So that's my thoughts. Michael, what other thoughts have you had in terms of episodes moving forward?
Yeah. What's kind of on my radar is alternative Android operating system comparisons. So obviously Graphene OS is very popular within the community. That's what I use. But we've had people email us and reach out to us about, you know, alternatives like Lineage or EOS or even stock Android and just drawing comparisons and contrast between those. So I think that would be an interesting episode that we sort of have started assembling some notes for. Also, payment masking, persuasion techniques for friends and family. That was another suggestion from a listener, which I think is a great topic, not just necessarily, you know, encouraging someone to use Signal or another, you know, chat app for your benefit, but how to start activating those values in other people to take privacy a little bit more seriously. And that also kind of goes hand in hand with the intersection of privacy and politics that I was discussing earlier. But we'll get into that, you know, in a future episode. There's also some interviews I'd love to do with other service providers and newer privacy-respecting developers. A few that come to mind are FileIn and GLINet, MySudo. I'd love to talk to some of the folks from Ladybird and Freely. So those are, you know, just a few off the top of my head. There's all kinds of projects that I'd love to chat with some folks from and get some more information and their perspective on the world around them and what they're working on in the privacy space. And I think the last thing we can discuss in terms of the future of Signal Jam are just a few new ways to connect. We've had a few requests from folks to start a SimpleX group chat, same thing with Matrix and also a Signal group chat. So those are all on the roadmap. Again, don't have an exact timeline for those, but we should have those probably up within the next couple months or so, probably after the next couple of episodes that we have a bit of a wider audience and folks who weren't maybe necessarily is interested in the privacy 101s will have a chance to listen to these next couple episodes, and then we might open those channels around that time. And just as a reminder, too, if you do want to get involved and chat with us now, we do have some channels available to do that. You can reach out to us on Signal. Our handle is signaljam.01. You can also send us an email through Proton or through Tuda. Our Proton email address is signaljampodcast@proton.me. And for Tuda, it's signaljam@tudamail.com. If you go to our website and look at the contact page, we have everything listed out there, all the different ways you can reach out to us, either directly or through our social channels too. So that's about it.
With all that in mind, that wraps up our Privacy 101 series for now. We're looking forward to the future, and I hope you found these helpful. Consider sharing an episode with a friend or family member who might have questions or just wants a way to get started. And we should have another episode out within a few weeks or so. So until then, stay private.